Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the founder and the host of the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast and the Rise Above Justice Movement. Today, I will give a viewer discretion as advised due to the nature of the topics that we will be discussing. Today, I am joined by my friend Maggie. Maggie, welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Absolutely. So feel free to... You know, I think people at this point and this, you know, at this time and at this day and age are used to podcasts, you know, having these deep subjects and, you know, they're prepared to listen and they also expect a lot of editing. But our podcast is different because we believe in the unedited, unscripted, and we also believe in the raw conversation. So we don't do a lot of editing. And the reason for that is to bring the human perspective and the human story in everything that we do, because the human story is so incredibly complex, just like healing. Healing is not linear, it is complex. Sexual and gender-based violence is not a linear subject, it is complex. As a survivor myself, I find it very healing to talk to other people who understand and who get it. Now, that's also saying that each survivor's story is individual. And while I don't speak for others, we do have a common factor that we want to see justice, which is where the Rise Above Justice movement comes in, which is a grassroots movement of sexual and gender-based violence survivors and allies coming together to focus on the intersectionality of marginalized voices. So again, welcome to the podcast. Feel free to introduce yourself to our listeners and walk us through your journey, my friend. It is a deep honor to sit down and talk with you today.
Oh, I so appreciate that. And thanks again for having me. I'm excited to be here. And I just love everything that the Rise Above Justice movement is about and everything you guys are doing. It's so important. There is no shortage of organizations, you know, like yours, but you know, the work that you're doing is really profound and impactful. So we need more organizations, in fact, like yours. So I'll walk you through kind of my journey. I grew up in a very small town in Eastern Iowa. I am the baby of five children. I grew up very Catholic, and that plays a role in my healing journey for sure. I began doing pageants when I was 11 years old, and I did pageants for 12 years. So most of my formative years I spent doing and being involved in pageantry. This was not a, you know, my mom did not enter me in like, you know, a JonBenet like type of vibe. It was very, you know, I wanted to do it. I was a very sassy and adamant 11-year-old. And I went to my parents and I was like, hey, I want to do a pageant. And they were like, okay, sounds good. So I think by their fifth child, I like to say that I think I just wore my parents down. They just kind of said yes to like all of the crazy ideas I had. So I entered my first pageant, and as the time, you know, time went on, I'm going to pause there. My dogs are barking. So as time went on, I went to college, I got my degree, and kind of in the midst of all of that, I developed a platform that was surrounding sexual assault education and prevention. So a platform in the world of pageantry is better known as a community service project. It's basically, you know, when we talk about like, you know, the quintessential pageant girl saying she wants world peace, that is sort of what your platform is. It's what you stand for. It's what you devote a lot of time and energy and effort into. And I decided to make my platform around sexual assault education and prevention because of a sexual assault that happened to me when I was 15. And so that was the first instance that I had remembered at that time. Later on in life, I will have remembered a child sexual abuse instance that happened when I was 7. And then again, as time went on, I had a rape that happened my senior year of college, about a week into my senior year when I was 21. So kind of had these multiple instances of sexual violence that had happened in my life, and, you know, was doing a ton of advocacy work, was working with organizations like RAIN and Rape on Campus and the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault. was going to the Iowa Capitol regularly to, you know, lobby for sexual assault education and prevention in schools, was going to high schools and doing those talks with students about consent, was doing a lot of work around, just sexual assault education. And I really wanted to help be a part of the solution. And so that kind of has led me to where I am now. I have a podcast called Pretty Furious, where my co-host and I talk about various issues, you know, in the world. There is no shortage of them, obviously, but predominantly we talk about women's issues and about the anger that women possess and kind of how that anger can be a part of change. So yeah, that's kind of like my story in a nutshell. And my experience with, you know, sexual violence, and kind of where I'm at now. So yeah, I'm trying to kind of like find a way to, get back into advocacy work in a way that feels good to me and feels, you know, healing and sort of like rejuvenating versus depleting. You know, I think it's easy for advocates to get very, depleted by this work. It's very arduous work. It's, time consuming, of course. It is, you know, it really takes a lot out of you emotionally. So yeah, I'm trying to kind of like find that, you know, that healthy middle ground, if there is one. So again, I'm just, you know, excited to be here to talk about my story, to talk about the healing process in particular, and love what you're doing.
Absolutely. It's a deep honor to, you know, sit down and talk to you. And you know, we've been connected on social media for a little while. And I remember whenever you agreed to be on the podcast, I got really excited. I was like, oh shit, it's about to get real, right? Now, pageantry.
Yeah.
So pageantry. We think about what we've learned about pageantry over the years. And we think about, oh God, this is such a deep subject and it's gonna go deep. I can feel it. But you know, what did you, how do I word this? Because, you know, as you mentioned, you know, being in pageantry and, you know, competing, and I've sat down and talked to some other former contestants and former winners of pageants as well, mainly in Canada, but there's a lot that goes into it. There's a lot of expectations. There's a lot of, you know, you have to be like this, you have to look like this, you have to this and that. There's so much of that go back and forth. What was that like for you? Like in that journey and in that space, what did you see? What did you hear? Just kind of give like a brief insight into that. I'm just genuinely curious.
Yeah.
From your perspective, you know, what are those ongoing themes in pageants?
Yeah, definitely. Well, of course, I can only speak for, you know, like when I was involved. So we're talking 2007 to 2019. But, you know, what I will say is during my time, like, of course, there is an aspect of empowerment. There is, of course, the opportunity to tell your story, to do advocacy work, to be involved in your community. Those are all great things that are associated with pageantry, or often associated with pageantry, and certainly were a huge part when I was involved. I was a participant in the Miss America system for many years. So that was one of the cornerstones of, you know, the Miss America system was really getting out into your community and really, you know, telling your story and spreading a message about organizations you deeply cared about and causes you deeply cared about. So I think that was obviously a sincere positive for me that allowed me to really develop my chops as an activist and as somebody who is really deeply passionate about women's rights. There of course is a trade-off. There's always a trade-off, right? Like there were plenty of negatives. And so I think, you know, the glaringly obvious negative associated with pageantry is like, you know, your appearance, how do you look? And so I think that was kind of for a lot of people, it's really hard to conceptualize a beautiful, thin white woman, who is involved in pageantry, being a rape survivor. That is very weird. People do not want to talk about that. That makes people very uncomfortable. It's not, you know, we're not supposed to talk about, these topics. Like that was sort of the message I was given from a young age was, you know, you choose a topic for your community service project or platform that is relatively easy to speak about, or something that is not as like, quote, deep. I was really one of the first people in, at least in the state of Iowa, I was one of the first people that I had seen, at least, who was talking about sexual assault very explicitly, and was kind of like very explicitly stating, this thing happened to me. It happened to me on multiple occasions. You know, the way in which I told my story was not up for debate, and it was not something I was interested in like dissecting with people. But it was something that I told very regularly. So there's also kind of the aspect of like your trauma being kind of like this medal you wear around your neck, right? Like where I had, you know, this platform that was very, very like, of course, well-received from all of my friends and from my family members and my board members and really my state. I was very fortunate to have people who were really supportive of my platform. But I think also there's like, you know, a sort of expectation that comes with it of like, okay, you're telling your story constantly. It is the way in which you tell it needs to be pretty and packaged and neat and not messy and not, you know, it doesn't need to be like coloring outside the lines, which is like the antithesis of what healing is and like what the healing journey really is. It is really messy. It is really like uncomfortable and can be really bizarre. And it's not something that anybody really, I think, wants like the in-depth conversation about. They want it to remain neat and easy for them to understand. So I think there's a lot of like that's involved. Kind of like doting around your trauma as if it's like this achievement that you've, quote, overcome, bearing in mind that like we obviously know that the healing journey is lifelong. It is not something that you just like check a box on a list. So I think all of those were like factors that I noticed that were, you know, pretty problematic. You know, but like, hey, I got a lot of scholarship money for college. So like, you know, there's like all these trade-offs that were associated with it. And those were the trade-offs for me. So I also would be remiss to not mention like the very clear aspect associated with appearance of like eating disorders were something that like everybody I knew involved in pageantry had some kind of like issue with eating. I had anorexia my sophomore year of college. I was, you know, fortunate to receive treatment and am good, but I know plenty of women who were not. And so that's another aspect that like, you know, people don't really want to talk a whole lot about is like, you know, the fact that people, you know, damn near kill themselves to like appease, you know, five random strangers on a judging panel, to win a title. So it's a brutal space sometimes. And, it can also be really fulfilling and really rewarding, but I would say for me, a lot of the negatives, unfortunately, outweighed the positives.
You know, and I know that there's a lot of other like cross intersectional, like, and then generational trauma and like pageantry too, you know, not just what we see on TV, but also just, you know, real life situations, right? And some of my friends have also competed in like dance. And I know that there's a lot in that and like gymnastics, you know, looking at like Larry Nassar and,
yeah, exactly,
you know, learning about all of that and learning how horrific he was to, you know, the girls that were competing. And oh my God. I remember sitting down reading some of those stories and like thinking about it, and unfortunately it's far too common, you know, it's far too, and it's oftentimes overlooked, and those are conversations people don't want to have,
but yeah, absolutely,
so incredibly important to talk about. Now, I think as a neurodivergent queer person, you know, like me specifically, I bring a lot of intersectional approach thinking about, you know, today's society, where we are as a society, and thinking about to like my own experiences. So how do you see the world right now? Like, obviously there's so much going on, but what is your vision and what do you see in the world right now, and what can we do to just be better humans?
Yeah. Wow, what a loaded question.
It is.
but a really good one. Yeah, I mean, I think I'll speak through the lens of like, I think what I see with women, if that's okay. I think with women right now, we're at a really like interesting crossroads where I think we are about to sort of usher in kind of the next wave or iteration of what feminism means. And so I think a lot of people get very weirded out by the fact that like a former pageant girl could possibly talk about feminism and like what that means. People have very like black and white notions about feminism and about what women's equality means and about women's rights. They have very like strict guidelines by which women's equality has to abide by. And I think the next kind of iteration of, you know, hopefully discovery for us and hopefully growth for everybody is what does it look like without those barriers? What does it look like when we kind of hang out in the gray area and not the black and not the white? I think that gray area is really important. It's my therapist always says like, it's both and, not an or, or a but or. So I try to remember that as I think about like where the world is today. It's like, yes, it is awful and it's lovely. It is, you know, incredibly difficult and there's a lot of joy. So it's both, right? We have to be able to hold multiple truths at a singular time. So I think that's kind of like the next iteration of like what I hope for the world is that we become better at holding multiple truths at a time. I think in terms of like, you know, as it relates to women, we're sort of in a really interesting phase right now, right? With like the trad wives of it all. And so there's like, you know, this notion that we want to return back to these quote unquote traditional values and like traditional way of being. And that's a woman's spot in the world is to like, you know, bear children, keep up the house, not have any involvement in the things that we are so lucky to have involvement in the first place. That, you know, many women who came before me fought for, you know, my right to be able to live the way that I do. So I think like, you know, we're at a really interesting kind of crossroads in that sense too, where we have to move forward in a way where, you know, the trad wives can understand that they can go and live and, you know, live on a farm and like, you know, milk their cows in the morning and take care of their 17 kids and like, you know, grow rhubarb or whatever the fuck it is they want to do. That's all fine and great. As long as, they understand that the women who, you know, are out here with, purple hair and are marching in the streets, you know, continuing that fight for our freedoms, as long as they can understand that, like, those are both valid ways of like being a woman. There is no like right, quote unquote, right way to be a woman. So, I think like, you know, the kind of like choice feminism of it all is really where we get stuck. And so I'm hoping that, you know, my hope for the world is that we can kind of move past that and move past the black and white and into an area where we exist with multiple versions of like what it means to be a woman, and what it means to be like a good woman, right? Like everybody wants to bring in like, well, what does a good woman do? And like, you know, that I hate that word good, but like, you know, everybody, any form of being a woman is like the right one. Like, you know, as long as you, respect the, rights and freedoms of your fellow women. So I think that's kind of where I hope the world heads. And I hope that we, you know, get through this mess and can kind of like work through the murkiness of it all to get to that place where everybody can agree at least on that, you know, there is no right way to do this thing, but respecting and fighting for each other's equality is equally as important.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a key part on it too. Is how do we as a society recognize the generational trauma that we're still experiencing in our communities? Now, let's pivot a moment and talk about, you know, some of the topics that you talk about on your podcast. You know, yeah. You mention a lot about, because there's a lot to be pretty furious about, no pun intended. but what are some of the things that you've heard from your guests that you've had or some of the topics that you talked about, and what's been the feedback for your podcasts that you've received too?
Yeah. Oh gosh. I mean, we've talked with tons of different women about a slew of topics, but I'll kind of name some of, like, you know, the episodes that maybe stick out to me, which the first one that comes to mind, speaking of like trad wives, is we had Tia Levings on, who is the author of one of my favorite books of the last year. And she just is a wealth of knowledge as it relates to, like, being kind of the OG trad wife and like what Christian nationalism looks like in America. She has taught me so much. And she's just, yeah, she's absolutely incredible. So we've had her on talking about kind of like, you know, how this sort of trad wife movement became mainstream, and how Christian nationalists, their entire goal for the country is to ensure that we return back to sort of that way of living. Yeah, she's just amazing. We have had Dr. Jessica Nurick on. She is incredibly popular in sort of the debunking the MAHA movement. So it's been really fascinating to learn from her too about like how the MAHA movement really plays into women's health and how every single thing that, you know, RFK Jr. and his cronies over in Washington are doing is really a play to like not give any of us freedom to make decisions about our own healthcare. So that's that. She's just been, she has taught me again so much about the MAHA movement and about like what the realities are of our current health landscape in America. Spoiler, they are not that bad. Like, that, you know, there are things that are, the MAHA movement is incredibly successful at, and one of those things is scaring people about their health and their health outcomes. So yeah, Dr. Jessica Nurick has been just so amazing, and I've learned so much from her. We have just had, yeah, we have been so lucky to have tons of different guests on. Paige Connell was our first guest ever. We are very proud to have had her on. She talks about kind of like the mental load and inequity in the home. And I think that as like somebody who wants a family, who wants children, that has been, you know, of course, at the forefront of my mind. So she's taught me a lot there. Yeah, we talk about, you know, all of those different things. They're all aspects of the female experience in America right now, and all things to consider. I think, you know, it has been, the feedback that we have received is like, you know, A, thank you for talking about this in a way that feels kind of like digestible and accessible. And B, that, you know, a lot of women especially are hungry for this kind of information. They're hungry to learn more about these different topics. Even if it seems like, you know, there's a lot of women who are just kind of like, oh, I want to like stay home and do the trad wife thing, which again is not a wrong way, quote, wrong way of being. But you know, there is a real hunger for, you know, more education around like where all of this is heading. And yeah, Christian nationalism is certainly at the core of it. So yeah, that's kind of been our, you know, experience so far. It's been absolutely amazing to be able to chat with all these people from different backgrounds. We feel very, very lucky that like we even, you know, get to do this and still have the ability to like talk into a microphone and say whatever we want about the Trump administration. So we are hoping that that doesn't go away anytime soon, but who knows? So yeah, we've had a really good experience with it, and we hope to just kind of keep plugging away and hopefully get even, you know, bigger guests on in the next year.
Yep. We've received similar feedback. You know, we break down these subjects, and I'm getting ready to do a couple different series and like some deep dives into a couple cases that I've been following. And
oh, I can't wait.
Oh,
I'm
just
so excited
wait.
For those. I'm
just
so excited.
Wait, because I have a really doozy one that I've been researching for the last year that I think is going to, it's a deep one. It's a deep dive into a couple different cases, but I'm also doing like a police report about policing over the last like century, essentially the last like 100, almost 200 years.
Oh, and fascinating.
I'm going to break that down and talk about, you know, mass incarceration, talk about, oh gosh, there's so much that's going to go into it. But whenever we're thinking about like traditional, like trad wife and like the traditional like lifestyle, I think about my friend Wynn Levy, who's actually my co-founder of the Rise About Justice movement. And she pops in every now and then but she's an independent music artist that grew up in the DMV area in Virginia. And she lives in Tennessee. She's an independent music artist, but she wrote a song titled Barefoot and Pregnant in 2023. And it's a satire song, but in actuality, is it really satire? Honestly, I don't know. But in the song, she talks about, being barefoot and pregnant and, popping out babies like a Pez dispenser. And it's such a, oh God, if anybody out there has not listened to Barefoot and Pregnant, it has over 20 million views across like all streaming platforms. And it keeps going viral because it becomes more like relevant to society today.
Yeah, totally.
Now, whatever we think about trad wife, I think about, you have to be this perfect size, you have to be this perfect, height, you have to be this, you have to be that. And that's like the true like dream, right? And it's kind of like fetishizing too, really. It goes really into that. And, I just interviewed somebody who talked about the, purity culture versus rape culture and how it's not actually really that much different,
Oh, yeah.
even if it is different at all. So I'm also interested to see how you think about that purity culture versus rape culture. What do you see as the same? What do you see as different, if there is anything?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, let me start by saying, I grew up very much immersed in purity culture because of growing up Catholic. I went to Catholic school kindergarten through 8th grade, and then I went to a public high school. And I will just tell you, I remember sex ed starting in 4th grade, and they called it the title of it was Growing in Love. And that was, our version of sex ed. And it was surface level, at absolute best. I didn't learn anything from it. I learned everything I knew about sex in high school. I learned, reading on my own. In college, I learned a lot. So I had no real understanding of sex or anything like that when I was younger. However, I was I what I did know was that, if I kept my virginity, that meant that I was, quote, good. That meant that I was doing something right. So I was basically the only virgin in my friend group up until I graduated high school. I held on to my virginity because I thought that it made me better or more sought after, or I had all these notions and feelings about what my virginity meant. And so that was certainly a product of the Catholic Church, growing up Catholic. And then I think on the flip side of that, I did my undergrad at the University of Alabama, where rape culture is arguably, at peak levels, in the continental US. It is, it was very normal for, quote, normal for girls to get their drinks drugged at parties. It was very normal for fraternity boys to just kind of do whatever they wanted to women, both at parties and at bars. It was just normalized. It was completely normalized. And so I think the similarity, the very glaringly obvious similarity between purity culture and rape culture, is that they are so normalized. Both of these kind of spectrums of behavior are the norm and are kind of what we know to be true about sex and gender in the United States. So that, I think, is where they have so much in common. I think that, the difference is obviously, rape culture puts, well, maybe this is actually a similarity, is both cultures kind of put all of the responsibility on the woman. So, rape culture is because of what she was wearing. It is because of the way she flirted, or the way she spoke, or the way that she looked, or the way that she looked at somebody, or whatever. Whereas, and purity culture is sort of the same, as she didn't keep her virginity. She was not the one who decided to remain pure. It is her responsibility to remain that way. So I think they actually have, quite a bit more in common than we think. Yeah, at least that's sort of, at first run through of that. I think that's what I'm gathering here as I say this out loud, is that they actually have way more in common than they are different.
Very much so. And it seems to be that that's a common theme amongst everybody that I asked that exact question. So, you know, thank you for your perspective on that too. And it's a very common answer that they're not really any different. And that I've seen that quite a bit. And I grew up around a couple of my, you know, my fellow classmates that also grew up in the purity culture. And I look at them now and it's like, how well did that work for you?
Yeah, exactly.
Because it did not.
Yeah, it did not work out for me. So it was not useful.
I was like, okay, how well did that work for you?
I lived in New York in my early 20s. It was not useful.
So that right there is like the debunk of it, right? And
yeah,
whenever totally. We think of like the decolonization of like our communities, right? Whenever we think about, you know, breaking free from purity culture and breaking from, you know, religious trauma, because there's so much trauma in that too. And, you know, I talk to a lot of trauma survivors and a lot of survivors of sexual and gender-based violence, because I also, I also think about this song that went viral. So I can't even talk about it because I'm going to get canceled for this, but there's a song that went viral that was kind of poking fun at, you know, like abstinence and, oh God, I can't even talk about it. I'm going to get canceled. I can feel it already. We're going to shift away from that. But anyway, so the work that you do now.
Amazing.
Sorry, I keep thinking about the song. It's in my head now, but. If anybody wants to know, feel free to ask me offline, because I'll send you the link to it, because you will find it humorous just like I did. But thinking about your work that you did in Iowa and thinking about, you know, meeting with legislators and thinking about, you know, I'm assuming you attended like meetings and stuff too, like the committees and such, right? And did you ever testify or anything, or?
No, I mean, you know, the most that was ever said when I was doing work, advocacy work as a pageant girl or as a title holder, was just that I was a survivor, right? Like that was really the only, kind of way of phrasing it that I felt super comfortable saying at the time. There was really a huge stigma and a huge, like, I don't know why I felt this way, but, I felt really uncomfortable using the term rape. So, that for me was like a big thing that I would say sexual assault survivor, instead of like rape survivor. So it was, you know, I very rarely like explicitly stated, that I was raped, you know, back then. And when I was doing most of my advocacy work back then, mostly, yeah, just because I felt like there was a huge like stigma around it. It was kind of too hard of a word. Like people didn't want to hear that. So yeah, that was really like the extent of me, you know, just like describing myself or my story was just like that I was a survivor. And so, yeah, I didn't really like, you know, testify or anything like that. I, you know, would sit in on these meetings and just kind of like soak in everything. And, I regularly did a lot of like speaking engagements and things like that, but that was kind of the extent of like the way in which I would describe my experience.
Did you ever get any of those looks? And I know you're going to know what I'm talking about whenever I ask this question. Did you ever get any of those looks like, so why are you here? And you know exactly what look I'm talking about, because I get it coming into talking, you know, to a group of people. I get this look like, why are we talking about this subject? Why are we, you know, this is still a taboo topic. Why are we saying this? Why are we saying that? Did you ever get any of those looks or have any of those similar like responses from people?
Oh God. Yeah. I mean, and I had them from like people who were relatively close to me, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, people who were like on the board of the pageant that I was involved in. Yeah, certainly. I had a lot of people who kind of gave me these like, you know, I'm uncomfortable. Why are we doing this sort of look? Which is, you know, kind of to my earlier point, like nobody wants to see like the last thing that people want to see is a pretty girl talking about rape. That is not something that people are interested in. Now I would argue like, you know, well, first of all, I would like tell those people like, go fuck yourselves. Like, you know, like, I don't really, like, I don't have, I have no like regard for the way that you feel about my trauma. Like that is not my responsibility to whittle down my story to make you feel more comfortable. Like that is not my job. My job is to be as honest as I can so that people understand kind of the breadth and the scope of this problem. And it is uncomfortable. Imagine how, like, you know, what I always, you know, tell people now in a lot of like my advocacy work and when I'm talking on the podcast and making content is like, sure, it might be really uncomfortable to hear a survivor's story, but think about how uncomfortable they are. Like, there is nothing that will beat the discomfort that comes from having to like regurgitate this story over and over and over again. So that's something that I always like, you know, try to keep in mind is, you know, nothing is going to ever like, you know, make me uncomfortable in that way, because I understand that whoever is speaking about their story, like it's theirs, it's not mine. It's not my job to sit there and judge it. It's not my job to sit there and say like, oh, I'm really uncomfortable with this. Like, I don't want to do this. Like my job is to sit there and to absorb it and listen and understand like where this person is coming from their lived experience. So, that's kind of like how I, you know, see this now is, you know, now that I'm older and wiser and don't really give many fucks anymore. So, so yeah, that's kind of like my view on it all.
Now, whenever we read the headlines, like especially right now, we read headlines. And, you know, I know every time I wake up, I get on my phone, see if my mom texted me is like the first thing I do, called or texted me while I was asleep. That's obviously the first thing that I do. But then I also start scrolling through Instagram. I scroll through Facebook. I scroll through like the Associated Press, which I have downloaded as an app because I use Associated Press because, you know, they're the most non-biased news source that we probably have out there right now. But reading these headlines, we see funding being cut for domestic violence and, you know, sexual assault organizations. You know, we see VAWA funding, which is Violent Against Women Act funding being completely cut or almost completely cut. But we also see like food stamps, Medicaid, cancer research, reproductive rights is on the chopping block again in certain states and nationally. These direct attacks against Planned Parenthood, which for anybody who's listening, I know they don't do just abortions. They do a lot of other reproductive health too. But I also think about our rural communities. You know, speaking of Iowa, there's a lot of rural aspects to Iowa. And I live in Kansas. I grew up in Missouri, you know, born and raised. And I did not spend most of my time on the playground. And I hope you caught that reference because that's a Fresh Prince of Bel-Air back. That's a Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, you know, speaking of blast from the past. But, you know, whenever we see on television, and speaking of blast from the past, I have been watching Special Victims Unit since I was a younger child. Mariska Hargitay is always going to be my first female crush. Always will be. Because she is stunning. She's a badass. She is a beautiful human being.
She's an icon.
She is. She's very iconic. She's a legend. And she always will be. And I think that's like the longest running, you know, primetime television show that everybody can reference. But it makes it look extremely easy that you could just walk into, and I've talked about this on previous episodes, but, and I plan on doing like a deep dive into the show too, is something that I really want to do, because, and kind of like pick it apart, because there's certain parts of it that is reality, but then obviously there's certain parts of it that is not reality. One of those non-reality parts is you can just walk into a police station and be automatically believed without being questioned. It's like, oh, I was raped.
Yeah.
And they make it look like, oh, you can just walk in and just say that. Well, first of all, you don't just say it out loud like that. I mean, hi, you know, I was raped over here. I'm a survivor. Like, you can't just do that.
Right.
They make it look so incredibly easy. And we know damn good and well, and I know from my own personal experience, but walking into my own police department thinking like, you know, okay, I'm going to file this report and I'm going to go into this room and I'm going to be questioned and I'm going to sit down and talk to a detective. Yeah, no.
Yeah,
That went
right.
right out the window, like people's IUDs. Sorry, Gwen, had to add
Yeah.
another reference in there, but I just, they make it look so easy to just walk in and just say, I was raped, and they take you into this room. But I did not have that experience. The experience that I had, and that, come to find out that multiple other women and men and queer people in my community had with this exact same department, they don't believe you. They don't
Yeah.
see you, and they just see you as just another person coming into a police station. There's another foot through the door. I
Right,
was
right.
asked, well, why didn't you fight him off? Or, oh, well, I'm sorry this happened to you, but at the same time, I still don't believe that this is worth reporting.
Right.
Excuse me, who the fuck are you to determine what I can and what I can't report? You're supposed to do your damn job. You took an oath to serve and to protect your community. However, who exactly are you serving and protecting beside yourself? Oh, but you let one of these cops rape somebody. Oh, it's the end of the world. We got to do this and we got to do that. It's like, this is the system working by design, working exactly
Yeah.
how it was designed to fuck over the poor and the working class, and especially marginalized people. Like, I think about that. So, what are your thoughts about Special Victims Unit? Make it, and like the other TV shows too. I also think about shows like Blue Bloods. I think about shows
Yeah.
like Chicago PD
Yeah.
and all those cross, sector TV shows. But so I guess my question is reality versus
Yeah.
fake,
Yeah.
essentially.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I am a yeah, I love SVU. I am a crime stan. Like I love true crime. I love yeah, all of the things. But I think when it comes to yeah, like when it comes down to it and when we look at reality, like yes, the unanimous kind of response when it comes to reporting and when it comes to particularly law enforcement, assault survivors and law enforcement is a negative one. It's a negative association. So, for context, so I grew up in rural Iowa, but I went to school, like I said, at the University of Alabama. When my rape happened, I remember very vividly, like going into the hospital that was in town. It happened off campus, so I went to the kind of off campus emergency room, and I had a very like what I will say is a relatively positive experience. I had an investigator who was great. Like he took my story, and he immediately said that he was like, well, we're gonna go and we're gonna go to this guy's house. And I actually was the one who was like, whoa, wait, like I don't know if I want you to do that yet, because I was friends with my assailant. So I felt really like sort of grateful that that they had such a desire to like go and actually pursue this. They believed me enough to go and they said, we want to go get this guy. And I remember the exact phrasing that this investigator used was, if this guy is a danger to other people on campus, we want to go get him. And I remember hearing that and thinking, that is not at all what I have heard from other people. That is not the experience I have heard from anyone else. And he followed up with me. He followed up with me, that weekend and then that following Monday. And ultimately, for reasons I won't get into, I ended up deciding to not press charges, but it ultimately was a really positive experience that I had with law enforcement, which I found to be incredibly shocking. And so and I recognize and understand the privilege in that not really anybody that I know has had a positive experience with law enforcement in that way. I also had a really positive experience with like the sexual assault nurse examiner that I had. I had a positive experience with the Title IX offices at the University of Alabama. But I also recognize that 2 years prior to my rape, the rape of Megan Rondini happened at the University of Alabama. So that was, a huge moment of camp our campus institution and Tuscaloosa at large, being problematic in the way that they handled an assault based off of the you know, assailant at hand, having a powerful family. So, you know, I recognize that there's very few people who have had the experience that I have had, and I'm grateful that I had it. But that's also not to say that I would have had a positive experience had I decided to press charges. So I have to keep that in mind, that, you know, my experience is one in a million. And the more common experience is one that you described, where you go in, they don't believe you. They brush your story to the side. They don't know how to handle or talk to survivors of sexual trauma. They don't know how to talk to trauma survivors, period. So I understand that to be the way more common experience for people.
That brings me into my next question, or I guess not necessarily the next question, but the next talking point. I was going to actually directly talk about the Megan Rondini case, because we mm-hmm. mentioned this during your pre-interview that we do. And yeah. This case is very complex too, because there's a lot that went into it. And
yeah.
I think about this, and this is a horrific case. It mm-hmm. seriously is. And
yeah.
I know that there was a wrongful death lawsuit that was mm-hmm. filed. And have you ever connected with any of the family of Megan, or like any friends or anything? Or just give us like an overview for those who yeah. do not know about this case. Walk yeah. us through what you know about it, and, you know, just mm-hmm. just kind of walk us through that for a minute.
Yeah. Megan was my age at the University of Alabama. We were actually in the same, like, I was actually in the same Rush group a couple of times as Megan. I had an interesting like Rush experience at Alabama, in the sense that I kind of got thrown into like random Rush groups. So I was actually in Megan's group a couple of times, and basically, you know, exact same age. It's Megan went to school at Alabama. My understanding of her story is that a very powerful man in Tuscaloosa, whose family was very powerful. His family had ties directly to the university. And basically he assaulted her. I believe there was, you know, talk of likely some, you know, drugging of drinks of sorts being involved. And then she ended up, because of that instance, transferring back home, you know, dropping out of the university, going back home to Texas. And then she unfortunately ended up dying by suicide. And so that case kind of lives rent-free in my brain, because the one of the investigators on her case was also one of the investigators on mine. And I had a very jarringly different experience from Megan. And I recognize that now as not necessarily a anything to do with like this investigator deciding to like, you know, phenomenally change his ways or like, you know, anything miraculous in that sense. But I recognize it now as more of like, you know, potentially a major fuck up. Yes. On his behalf, that he recognized in the way that he was working with survivors, and also sheer luck, right? Like, I think on any other day, any other, case, any other time, my situation could have been vastly different, right? And I think about that a lot as it relates to Megan. Like, we were the same age. It's very like it really you know, keeps me thinking a lot about kind of like the broader politics of the University of Alabama and the campus there, and how problematic it truly is and still is to this day. It is not a it is not a perfect institution by any stretch, and in fact is still deeply flawed. So, but there was a wrongful death lawsuit that was filed against the university, that was settled, you know, for undisclosed settlement with her family. And I've never reached out to her family directly, although I have felt kind of like inclined to, but I have worked with, I worked for a couple of years ago, I worked on a mission that was the Alabama Survivors Fund, which is an on-campus nonprofit that was basically dedicated to raising funds for survivors who were kind of like in the immediate aftermath of their assaults. So what are the tools and resources that somebody who does not have privilege, who does not have family who can support them, who does not have the resources that someone like I did, what would be the things that they would need and what would they need money for, right? They would need money for therapy. They would need, you know, maybe they would need clothes or money for food or housing or, you know, things like that. So I worked closely then with two women who were very familiar with the Rondini case. And it's sort of something that I think if you went to Alabama in those years and you were also in the Greek system and like knew this man who was her assailant, you understood how lucky you were, like how your experience could have also been that experience, but it for whatever stroke of luck was not. So that's my, you know, my understanding of her case. Like I said, I think about her and her family a lot. So I, you know, that's not to say that I would never like reach out to her family, but my hope is that they, you know, can find some peace in, you know, what has transpired since her case and since her death, unfortunately. But I also, you know, understand and respect the fact that, you know, nothing will bring their kid back. So, and what happened to her was, completely avoidable. It was something that, you know, a really, really bad man, did to her. So yeah, it's a really complex case and it's a really, you know, unfortunate and sad one.
Yeah. You know, upon doing research about this case, and I think I'm going to cover this case more in depth, like as part of a series that I'm going to do, around, you know, these topics of like college campuses, because there's another one that I think about in, I believe it's the University of Utah, which was Lori McCluskey. That case struck a lot of chords with a lot of people. And my friend Celine Beth Olson is a survivor, but is also a true crime podcast producer, but also a true crime producer, and has worked with like families like Don Walsh, you know, as a producer on the In Pursuit of John Walsh show. But she's an incredible person. But she lives in Utah and went to the University of Utah, and she was very connected to the Lori McCluskey case. And I did learn, you know, going back to Megan Rondini, I did learn that the mom passed away of cancer in 2019.
I think I knew that. Yeah, I think I had heard that somewhere.
That's incredibly sad. You know, it really is. And I just, oftentimes we hear about cases like this and it just leaves me dumbfounded, because it's like, you know, one is too damn many and three is obviously astronomical, because that at that point, you know, that's a serial, you know?
Right.
But, you know, other than that, I think, you know, we just need to focus really heavily on the prevention part, but also that postvention. You know, how do we prevent re-victimization, and how do we recognize as a society that we still have this issue of rape culture that still exists? And who do young men, and I know not all perpetrators are men, but for some reason I always see about a man, but not all men, but always a man.
Yeah, not all men, but most of the time.
Just saying.
Yeah.
I know women can be, I know trans people can be, I understand that, but it's a very, very, very low number.
Very, very small percentage, yeah.
And like not even like a 1%, where the other 99 is typically a man. But whenever we think about that, I think about organizations like Callisto. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with Callisto?
I've heard of them, yeah. I'm not like super familiar with their mission, but yes, I've heard of them.
So Callisto has created an encrypted website that if you have a .edu, you know, email address to your college campus or university, you know, whatever, you can gain access and you can go in and, you know, view like anonymous information about people who have reported their assault. And essentially, you know, it kind of shows you like, okay, this person. Obviously, it's anonymous. You can't really see, like, you know, who it is other than the perpetrator. You know what I mean? Like, you can see that, but you go in and input, like, this person's name. You know, if you suspect, like, well, you know, I kind of feel a little uneasy about this, or, you know, I feel a little bit different about this person, you can go in and type in their name, and you can see if anybody's reported about this person at all. Yeah, and
Wow.
I think it's incredible. And it's a way to end that serial sexual assault. I sat down and talked to Tracy, who is the CEO of Callisto. And essentially, Callisto's mission is to use technology to empower survivors of sexual violence. And on their website, they talk about the what. So Callisto started with a goal to build a system that empowers survivors, rebuilding their sense of agency, prioritizes privacy, and facilitates coordinated action. The solution is the Callisto Vault, which, as I stated, is an encrypted, that's a new one, encrypted platform designed to empower survivors of sexual assault. Sorry, I keep going back to the encrypted part. I gotta have a little bit of a comedic approach. I cannot speak today. Comedic approach to this podcast because these are obviously very deep subjects, but they created this encrypted platform designed to empower survivors of sexual assault, provide a safe alternative to reporting, and increase the likelihood that serial perpetrators will be held accountable. Within that vault, the Callisto Vault, survivors can access two tools, the matching system and the incident log. The matching system is the first and only tool that utilizes, I am not going to try to say that word, to provide a secure alternative to a whisper network to determine if others were harmed by the same perpetrator. The matching system allows a survivor to enter the unique identifiers, like social media handles, of the perpetrator, and if another survivor enters the same unique identifier, a match occurs. Any serial perpetrator can be detected regardless of their university affiliation. Once matched, each survivor is connected with a legal options counselor who will explain their options and can facilitate coordinated action while protecting survivor privacy. I am in awe of Callisto.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I adore them. I love them. Tracy has been doing this for over 20-something years. So she brings a lot of knowledge and a lot, like a big wealth of knowledge into this advocacy space. And I am mind blown by the work that they do. I think it's so incredible. And there's not a lot of organizations that are doing this type of work either, like specifically like this. Now, there's another organization based out of the UK that's called Enough, and Enough to End Rape. And I sat down and talked to Katie White, who's a co-founder of that organization in the UK. And I think hearing her perspective on the United States and then also seeing what's happening in the UK, it's one and the same. Like these systems across the world are designed the exact same. So to anybody out there who may be feeling, some type of way about our systems, realize that we are not the only one that is dealing with this. It is all across the world. But Maggie, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. Is there
Thanks for
anything else?
having me.
Is there anything else that you would like to share with, anybody who's out there listening that may need some type of like encouragement or, to keep going? And then also, how can people find you on social media and listen to your podcasts?
Well, I'll start with the latter. So people can find me on social media. It's at It's Maggie Burnett everywhere across all platforms. And then our podcast is at Pretty Furious Pod. You can find us literally anywhere that you get your podcasts. And also on Instagram and TikTok and all the places. And then just kind of, like closing remarks for anybody who might need encouragement, anybody who might be a survivor themselves. I think like it's hard to exist in a world that has sort of like dampened the concept of like what it means to be a survivor. I think we saw the Me Too movement that really like, increased awareness, and now it's sort of like, we hear about sexual assault so much. We have a predator in the White House. We shameless plug, release the Epstein files. And like we see so much of this in like mainstream media and in our culture that like I think I speak for myself when I say like I've become a little bit numb and desensitized to it. So I think like if I could offer anything to other survivors and everyone out there is, try not to let that happen to you. Try not to let yourself become desensitized to your own story and to what is going on. It is not normal. It is not normal to have someone in the White House who has been accused of harming women on as many occasions as he has. It's not normal for him, for whoever is in the White House, to be accused at all. This is not something that, like, him and all of his friends being accused and normalizing violence against women is not normal. And I think, like, we live in a reality right now where, like, this kind of concept of hypernormalization or making normal the very not normal is unfortunately, like, you know, what we are dealing with. We're dealing with hypernormalization right now. So I think, like, you know, I offer to people, like, how can you find your humanity? Like, what are the ways in which you can find that? For me, that's writing. For me, that's, you know, being with people I love and taking a break from the news and from social media when I can. And I offer that question to other people to, like, explore the ways in which their humanity can be restored, whether that means being outside or, you know, watching great cinema or listening to music you love or painting or drawing or, like, whatever it is, find those things and make them a non-negotiable. I think that's really what our world needs right now, is people who are making their humanity and the practice of their humanity a non-negotiable. So, yeah, I'll just offer that to anybody who may need it or identify with it.
Bringing truth to power is exactly what I am aiming to do. And by highlighting the experiences and stories of those who do not reach the headlines, I think is incredibly powerful in today's society. And again, shameless plug, release the Jeffrey Epstein files. Yes, absolutely, 100%. I have to bring it into everything I do. But I am deeply excited, you know, to continue collaborating with you and uplifting the work that you are doing. And, you know, you have an open invite anytime you want to be on this podcast or have anything you want to talk about, anything pertinent, however you see fit. Feel free to reach out anytime. Now, to anybody out there who's listening, please follow Maggie on social media. Listen to the Pretty Curious podcast, which I'm excited to do a deep dive and listen to myself.
Yay.
And with that, Maggie, thank you again for coming on the podcast. You take care of yourself, my friend, and I will talk to you very soon.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. Thank you. All right.